Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. America's electrical grid, an engineering triumph of the 20th century, is turning out to be a poor fit for the present. Today, as we invest great hope in new energy sources like solar, wind, and other alternatives, the grid is what stands in the way of a brighter energy future. If we hope to realize this future, we need to reimagine the grid so that it fits the needs and values of the 21st century. This morning, we talk with cultural anthropologist Gretchen Bakke, author of The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future, about how Americans are changing the grid right now, sometimes with gumption and big dreams, and sometimes with legislation or the brandishing of guns. Gretchen, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It wasn't that long ago. I probably, like most Americans, didn't think that much about the grid. And there's certain things that make you think about it, like when you have a major blackout that covers a good part of the region that you live in. The first time I actually thought about the grid was back in the 70s when I was a hippie living in the land, and I knew people who lived off the grid. And that was the first time that I thought about what it meant to be on the grid. So let's start by talking about what it means to be on the grid, what the grid is, and how do we get off of it?
Well, it's not so much that we want to get off of it. It's that we want to make it work differently than it has been. But, and we'll get to that probably in the, you know, in 20 minutes. But to be on the grid simply means that we have electricity that isn't made at home. And in the 1970s, a lot of people who were off the grid didn't have electricity at all. And that's sort of what, is in our mind, that's the imagination of being off the grid, is that you don't have these services. You have a well and you have a, you just don't use electricity. But now most of the people, even people who are off the grid, they have electricity. They just are doing it much more privately. And so anything that is a system that makes electricity, transmits electricity, and has machines that use that electricity is a grid. It can be tiny or it can be gigantic. And the thing about the what we now are calling the macro grid or the big grid is that it's huge. It's the biggest machine in the world. And in the U.S. we have three of them. One for the whole western half of the country, one for the whole eastern half of the country, and one for Texas. And in part of this reimagining of the grid, which is happening right now all over the place, people are kind of stepping back from that bigness, not necessarily all the way down to the household size, but they're kind of trying to rethink how that bigness works, when it works, when it's really, really valuable, and when it's not so valuable, when it leads to things like cascading blackouts.
I wanted to actually go back a little bit and talk about how we got to this grid that we have. What were the forces that kind of imagined it and then got it to be this behemoth that basically controls our lives now?
Yeah, I mean, it controls our lives in really completely awesome ways, too, I have to say. The thing is, electricity is, it's really, it's everywhere. It makes everything possible in many, many ways. And if we go to electric cars, it's going to make even more things possible. So I'm certainly not speaking ever against electricity or even against grids. It's just how to rethink it to be greener and be a little smarter. So anyway, your question about the past is that it's really business. We had the capacity to make electricity about 40 years before we figured out what to use it for. So already in the 1850s, it was fairly easy to make it, but no one knew what to do with it. And the first thing that people figured out to do with it was to make light. And part of that light was for miners in the Sierra Nevadas, gold miners, and this is in the late 1800s. They could mine at night if they had light. And part of it was for office workers and the press. And that just meant that clerks, for example, in the sort of the new economic centers of the country could actually stay at work at their desk after dark. And there was gas lights, but they were really hard on the eyes and they were hard to see by over a long period of time. So electric light was really this thing that kind of allowed white-collar work largely on the East Coast to kind of to extend its hours. So that was the appeal in the beginning. And then we got what are called or have long been called natural monopolies. The electrical utilities in the early 1900s as economies of scale, so this idea of how it is that you can actually make money on electricity, because that was very hard. It took about 40 maybe even 50 years for anybody to figure out how to make a dime. And part of making money was just serving as many customers as possible, not all at once. Electricity isn't quite like other things. It's not like I need to sell the most bananas I can, and therefore I will be able to sell them cheaply and make a good profit. It's more like I have to be able to sell the same number of bananas, if we are just in quotes, at every minute of the day, so that my power plant can run at the same amount, at the same level, all day, all 24 hours. And so creating an electricity market of scale meant consolidating all different kinds of customers into the same grid. So you had industrial customers who could be asked to work in the middle of the night or in the middle of the day. You had streetcar companies that really ran during the commuting time. You had offices that ran after dusk. So all of these different kinds of and streetlights then in the evenings, all these different kinds of users were brought into the same system. And in order for it to work at full capacity, it got really big. And that happened first in Chicago, but it spread pretty quickly to all the urban areas. And then during the Great Depression, we got the idea of electricity for everybody with the Rural Electrification Act.
Well, before that, we had these giant grids, like the streetcars started out having their own grids, didn't they?
They have their own grids, yeah. Everybody, and that's the thing it's just so amazing, is that there is this like 30, 40-year period of time where there was this massive proliferation of grids. So streetcars had their own grids. And they had a certain shape. They sort of stretched out over the city. And you can imagine this in Portland, right? Like, just imagine if the streetcar system actually just made its own power and didn't share that power with anybody else. They just produced, they had a little DC generator, and they just produced the power they needed to move the streetcars around. That's how it was, except there would be maybe four or five competing streetcar companies in an urban environment. And then factories made their own electricity, the ones who wanted it. Certain companies made their own electricity. Streetlights made their own electricity. There was just a huge number of overlapping systems. And a lot of people know about this argument between Tesla and Edison. It's kind of famous. But at the grounds of that argument are the difference between DC power, which doesn't go very far, and isn't very flexible, and AC power, which you can transmit very long distances. And so as AC power became sort of preferred in the 1890s, it became then possible to think about scale in a different way.
Now, I just wonder what the advantages were of combining all these grids into one single grid, and whose idea was that, and who benefited from that?
Well, it was the age of monopoly, the late 1800s. So Samuel Insull gets the credit, and he was a phenomenal thinker because it was such a weird idea to think with time, to think about a product in time as opposed to a product that you can stockpile. Like coal, you can just put it in a warehouse, and when someone needs coal, you can control the price of coal based upon how much of it you bring out of that warehouse at any given time. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve helps us do exactly the same thing right now. But the great thing about electricity that many people don't realize is that you can't store it. And so you have to make it and use it at the same moment. And so figuring out how to make a monopoly out of something that has to be produced and used at the same time was just a phenomenal feat. And it took Insull probably 15 years, 12 to 15 years, before he finally figured out how to put all the pieces together in Chicago. And as soon as he did that, everybody started to copy that, his system.
So to whose benefit was it, actually? I mean, did it help the consumers, or was it really better? It was more of a benefit for the owners?
Well, it's definitely a mix, right? Like many businesses, it's a mix. The fact that there was electric light brought actually into people's homes. The fact that there was the idea that selling electricity very cheaply to as many people as possible, those things didn't exist before the move toward the monopoly happened. But also Insull got very, very rich. And he also, his empire was bankrupted with the Great Depression as well, because he was a little tricky with his holding companies in almost the same way that Enron was being tricky with their holding companies almost a century later. So it's both to the benefit of society. I think we now think of electricity as a public good, like drinkable water, like clean air. And it's also very much a benefit to the companies that make it, especially after the monopoly system was in place. I mean, we know this because every time we play monopoly, the first thing that anybody does is try to get all the railroads and the electrical utilities, right? Because there's always a return. Even in the game, there's always a return. And all the way through the 1970s, there was the same kind of promised return. If you invested in a, if you're an investor and you buy stock in a utility, you were gonna get money back because of the relationship between government regulation and the utilities that promised a return on every dime the utility spent. So if they built a giant power plant, you were gonna make money if you were a stockholder. That is not necessarily true anymore. Things have broken down in all kinds of interesting ways. Since the late 1970s, but definitely for 60 years, cheap, very cheap electricity for as many people as possible was the way to make money. So the two interests aligned.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit more about going off the grid and what that meant in the 70s, because I actually knew a number of people who were generating their own electricity in different ways. It started out as people having car batteries that they would somehow get charged. I guess they go to the gas station, charge them, and then they run little things off of that. And I had friends up in Canada in the 70s who could run a cassette deck and a few light bulbs and stuff off of this car battery. Later on, I think in the early 80s, I had friends in Southern Oregon who actually had solar panels, and they were running their larger computers off of solar panels. Mm-hmm. So there was just not just the idea that you live completely simply like Thoreau, but some people are actually into what we're calling appropriate technology back then. But there seemed to be a concern about getting away from some of the a lot of it had to do with people like Insel, you know, like you wanted to get away from these corporate greedy people and be able to generate your own power and your own life and your own destiny, basically. I wonder how that kind of, the tension between that and the big grid and how that played out a little bit later when we started watching the grid begin to deteriorate.
I think that one of the things that was happening in the early 1970s, sort of as the OPEC oil crises were just sort of breaking over the country, and the Vietnam War was happening, was this sense that, and the environmental movement was happening, and nuclear power plants were beginning to come in and be protested, was this sense on the part of everyday Americans that there was no way to intervene. Like that there were these very big, sort of hardened bureaucracies that you couldn't talk to anymore. You couldn't make them see things differently or practice things differently, do things differently. You just had to kind of either go out on the street and protest or sort of bow your head to them. Or in the case of the grid, just walk away, right? Like just turn your back. And the utilities were like that too. And so the protest movements that were kind of rising during that time, they gave this sort of opened things up, I would say, for the election of Carter, who's the person who really kind of put a tiny crack, in what was called the utility consensus at that time, that has since broken and shattered in so many ways because of that first crack. And I think that there was just this desire for something, some way in, some way to just make some kind of move besides, okay, I'm turning the light off, right? I grew up in the 1970s in Astoria, actually. I don't know if you know that. I'm an Oregonian. And just like I remember just being followed around by the nuns. We had nuns, and you had to turn off the light and turn off the light and turn off the light. But that was what you could do, right? Unless you actually went off the grid, that was sort of all you could do. And even that, because of the way that the billing system was set up, you didn't see it reflected in your bill. It was very hard to determine how actions toward conservation actually were making any difference in the world. And that changed in the late 1970s with the Energy Policy Act. But the reason it changed is because there had already been a decade of people pushing back. Some of that was people getting off the grid, but a lot of it was people like the Office of Appropriate Technology in California that were saying there's other ways to do this.
Well, you actually, in your book, you talk about, I guess, the Cardigan movement. But,
yeah.
But what does that mean?
Well, the cardigan path, it simply means, like, wear a sweater and turn down the heat, right? Like,
that's what Jimmy Carter would do.
It's kind of this idea of, like, modest privation is okay. This is not how we think about things today, but in the late 1970s, there was this idea that, like, modest privation is okay because it's a way of saying we, the people, can take some sort of action and have a value set which is not aligned with the institutions which are governing us. Carter did, when he wore this for his first fireside chat as the president, he wore this cardigan, and he basically said, "I'm with you guys. I'm turning down the heat in the White House too. I'm putting solar panels up in the White House too." You know, and that was really he did it in policy, and he also did it symbolically.
Well, it seems to me that actually as you mentioned in the book, that how that wouldn't fly at all today because we are in such an age of hyper-consumerism. But I wonder if we couldn't use a little bit of privation again and look at how we don't need most of the things that we think we need now.
Yeah, well, with electricity, what's interesting is that our uses is electricity use in the U.S. has been flat since 2008, which is kind of amazing given how many more computers and server farms and people, social media, and just people there are. And part of that is still a legacy of this sort of late 1970s moment of our machines are just much, much more efficient than they ever were. So even though we don't necessarily turn off the lights, those lights, if you're not using an incandescent bulb, if you have LEDs, for example, they just use way less electricity. If you have an Energy Star appliance, it just uses way less electricity. If you have a smart thermostat, you're using way less electricity. And so there's this way in which the idea of privation is sort of been lost, but the idea of efficiency is very popular right now, that things should be actually more efficient than they are.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Gretchen Bakke, who's author of The Grid, Freeing Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. Well, actually, when I switched over to LED lights a few years ago, I started leaving the lights on. Actually, I started doing that when we had compact fluorescent bulbs because, in fact, that kept them alive longer.
Yeah, you're supposed to. It's
right.
So awkward.
It was a terrible habit. So I would do this, and so I'd leave my LEDs on, and I think, well, they don't cost anything anyway. They're going to last for 20 years. But in the last year or so, I've started turning them off and treating them like incandescent bulbs. So I think that there's this place, even though we have more efficient equipment, like the whole idea of leaving your computer on all the time, and we leave these things on that we don't need to have on. So I think that if we were to kind of reshape some of that thinking, we could use, even instead of our energy usage being flat, it could actually start to be reduced.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the problems that the grid went into. Back in 1965, I remember I think it was the first great Northeast blackout, which ran from, I think, Maine down to Philadelphia, or maybe all the way to Washington, D.C. It was a very exciting evening, and I lived in central Massachusetts. We were only without power for about, maybe 3 or 4 hours, but my brother was living in New York City, and they were without power for 24 hours, and he had a much more exciting time than I did trying to get home. But before that, the only time you'd ever lose your power, it seemed, would be in an ice storm or a really severe snowstorm or a hurricane, which didn't happen all that often in central Massachusetts. But the idea of having this whole region be without power was quite an amazing feat, in that I don't think it really happened again on such a great scale until 1977. And that blackout was not such a happy event, as I recall.
No.
So let's talk about what caused these blackouts, and what was it indicating about the state of the grid, even as far back as 1965?
Well, I think the thing that was interesting about the first one is exactly the feeling that you're pointing to, which is like, oh, this can happen. It's like, wait a minute, this can happen, and it's called a cascading blackout, and so it means that there's a little thing. In this case, it was an incorrectly set relay outside of Buffalo, I think. A tiny, tiny little thing that then causes a kind of imbalance very locally, which propagates. And because the grid by the 1960s had become there was so much interlocking equipment, so many, the wires, the generators, the substations going across state lines, all of this stuff, which is all it's all oscillating at exactly the same pace, which is 60 hertz. And so you disturb it in one little way, and that just that just sort of moves, it sort of pushes this blackout across a span which is just inconceivable, especially before then. And what happened as a result is that of that first blackout and the East Coast is a lot of duplication of wires. And so for a long time, and even now our blackouts are often shorter because there are duplicate lines running in the same direction. So that was kind of the response was like, oh, this is an interesting problem. Let's fix it. And I think that it points actually to the way that the grid both breaks down and gets reformed into the present moment, which is this constant series of realizations that are of a problem that we didn't know was there before, and then a set of solutions to that problem, which then produce new problems. And the only way we learn about those new problems is because something breaks down. And then there's a set of solutions, and then there's new problems. So after the 2003 blackout on the East Coast, which was also a rolling blackout, it could have just stayed in Ohio, but because of a couple of different problems, one of which was a computer bug, it didn't. It covered the whole, and I believe there were portions of the East Coast that were out for 2 or 3 days with that one, but with each of these kinds of blackouts, it's like, oh, we've done something that doesn't work. So now we're going to do a new thing that is going to maybe make it better. So we put all this money into the transmission network. It was a transmission network, which is the big lines, not the little lines in your neighborhood, but the big lines. So our transmission network got very, very good over the next 5 to 8 years. But one of the things that happened that surprised everybody is that suddenly all of the interesting stuff and all of the strain was on the distribution network, which is the wires that are in our neighborhoods. And so now there's all of this attention being paid to the distribution network. So each of these flaws, it kind of, there's this lag, and then there's like, okay, let's upgrade this thing. Okay, let's think about this thing differently. Okay, let's make these slight little changes, and hopefully it will work better. And because of that, there are sort of ebbs and flows in how many blackouts we have, how long they last, what parts of the countries they show up in. As the grid is kind of changing its sort of the deep organizational structure of the grid right now is changing. And yet, as an end user, many people don't realize that that's happening. Even when you put solar panels up on your house, you're a part of that. You're pushing at the grid, making it work differently than it used to. But there isn't necessarily this awareness of how much the infrastructure has to change in order to accommodate that.
Well, but before we get to the challenges of the old grid trying to deal with all these new kinds of energy generation, I'm thinking about some of the vulnerabilities that have come out. And there was a large West Coast blackout, which actually didn't come, at least didn't go as far north as Portland. It might have hit southern Oregon, but it wiped out power for a very long period of time, I think over a day from like southern Oregon down to San Diego. And it all started with, I think, a tree in an apple orchard in Washington County here in Oregon that touched the wire. And it showed two things, interesting things, the vulnerability of the grid to things like trees, branches that are not pruned properly or somehow get in the way of the wires. And the other thing that was interesting, that Oregon wasn't part of this blackout that was caused by a cherry tree or apple tree here in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And the East Coast blackout also was caused by three trees actually coming into contact with wires. And there was a big blackout, I think in 2011, in the southwest that was caused by a lineman just sort of resetting a line in the wrong way. So it's these simple things, and trees are there's a lot of talk right about cyberterrorism right now, which is something to think about and pay attention to. But to date, trees and other sorts of foliage are the biggest threat to the grid, and I think that's also kind of amazing. It's hard to be afraid of trees, but it's also really hard. They're growing all the time, you know, and there's so many wires, and you're constantly having like, it's a big expense for the utilities to constantly be trimming back trees. And a lot of those trees are on private property, and people don't want to let the tree trimming crews in. And then there's also sort of a history of saving money on the part of the utility by just, instead of trimming trees every 3 years, you trim them every 5 years, or instead of having three people on a tree trimming crew, you have two. And it's just sort of this secret budget line where you can skim money off the top, and it works really well until the blackout comes.
Well, actually, my next door neighbors were sort of a little microcosm of this problem. Many years ago, a previous owner of the house planted a tulip poplar right next to the power pole. And it grew up into the crown of the tree, was covering up the relay at the top of the pole. And so periodically, Portland General Electric would come and they'd prune the tree back, and they just kind of top it. So the tree just got wider and wider as it was being topped. And it just became more and more of a mess. And finally, last year, the pruners came from Portland General Electric, and they turned it into a giant bonsai tree. And it was very weird. It just had a few branches with, you know, a few bunches of leaves on it. And my neighbors, who are like three generations later from the person who planted the tree, are looking aghast because we had complained about the tree to them and thought, you know, this is not the right tree to have in the street. But there they were recognizing it's time for the tree to go. And so they, PGE at that time, made them an offer they couldn't refuse, which is, we'll pay to take out the tree. And right. then you can put in something that's a more appropriate street tree if you want. And they came out and took out the tree, and the whole neighborhood was, you know, kind of complimenting our neighbors. And, boy, it's really nice that tree is gone. But I thought, like, this is like a small example of what, like, probably happens all over the country.
All over the country, all the time. And every time you see, when you're driving in a neighborhood and you see one of these grand old trees that basically has a circle cut through the middle of the branches somehow with a wire running through the middle of it, you know, that's it. Just maintaining that from one year to the next, especially in the Pacific Northwest where things just, you know, grow rampant, you know, it's really hard.
Well, I also wondered, though, why they don't put the wires underground. I mean, it's one thing in New York, though we can get into it in a little bit, why New York is certainly not invulnerable to power outages either. Mm-hmm. But, so, I mean, when I lived in New York City, I mean, there's no wires hanging in the streets. They're all underground. And I'm wondering why in so many cities the wires are still, like in Portland, just there's a whole nest of wires that hover throughout the air.
Right. So there are a couple of reasons. One is that it's extremely expensive to bury wires. So if the system is above ground, it's pretty rare that it will get changed to be below ground. And there are places like Pasadena that had an above ground wire system, and there was a big argument between Pasadena and Oakland because they both wanted to bury their wires. And Oakland wasn't rich enough, and Pasadena was. So Pasadena now has underground wires, and Oakland does not. So that's one thing. The second thing is that there are lots of places where burying the wires, if it's tidal, which is to say, if the water table comes up quickly, you don't want to have underground wires.
Such as
in New York City, exactly, or in Manhattan at least. Right. You don't want the wire. And that was a big problem with Superstorm Sandy, is that the electricity system was underground. In Florida, you don't want, it's basically a swamp, right? So you don't want to bury your wires. And they have had problems there because even their substations are on low ground. And so part of, like, protecting the grid in Florida has been putting critical equipment on the third floor, for example, of a building instead of the ground floor, and then building these little artificial hills and putting substations on top of these hills. Then you in Oregon, everywhere, but especially on the coast, not everywhere, sorry, not in the east, but
Western Oregon.
In the valley and on the coast, there's so much rain that the ground can just be sodden. Or it's tidal, which means the water is coming up out of the ground. As the tide comes in on the coast, the water comes up out of the ground, and then it recedes back into the ground again. You see these cows standing in fields, like up to their knees in water, like munching away at the grass, right? And so you just don't want to bury any place that's that wet. You don't want to bury your lines.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Gretchen Bakke, who wrote a book called The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. And now we're going to talk about some of the problems with having this massive grid, both in terms, well, we just talked about some of the problems we have, like with cascading blackouts and things, because the grid is just overloaded. But we want to talk about a little bit about some solutions people have found as a result of being stranded without electricity for a long period of time. And there's an interesting story you tell about the there was an amazing series of storms on the Oregon coast, and they have to remind me when. I think it was 2007, right? And people in Portland remember it too. I mean, we had pretty big storms here, but on the coast, it just was devastating, and people were without power for week or even more. And it's an isolated area. Roads were cut off because of all the mudslides and the downed trees. And people, it was sort of a foreshadowing of that 9.0 earthquake that we're all expecting.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite as bad as that would be, but it really cut off the coast. So I was interested in talking about some of the lessons that some of those people learned as a result of being without power for so long.
I think there became, there's two things that happened because of that storm that I saw. One is that there was this subtle but pervasive loss of faith in utility-provided electricity. And so it wasn't that people were like, in this 1960s, 1970s way, saying, like, I'm getting off the grid, I don't want to have anything to do with my utility anymore. It wasn't like that. It was like, I'm happy to have electricity when it's coming through, but I'm no longer going to have faith in the fact that it will come through. And so people went about dealing with that in very different ways. Some people got generators. Many people had generators to begin with, but a lot of other people got generators. Some people hooked into the natural gas network, and so they got natural gas heaters, natural gas hot water heaters. I think those are sort of the two main. You can't have solar on the coast. And wind, at least in small wind, which it's a technology which was quite sort of popular and interesting in the early 2000s and has fallen out of vogue since then. But it works just like solar panels. But in most towns and cities, not San Francisco, interestingly, but most towns and cities, you're not allowed to have a small wind turbine.
Even though you're going to put solar panels on your house.
Even though you can put solar panels on your house. So, but in places like the Oregon coast, you can't really put solar panels on your house because there's no light. And you can't have small wind because it's not allowed. And so there's not these kind of... and a lot of people don't want generators because they want to move away from fossil fuels. But also, in the interviews that I did along the coast after that storm, there was a constant critique of the fact that you can't... If you have an outage for 2 or 3 days, your generator's empty anyway. You're just as much at risk if you're relying upon diesel, because you're going to run out of diesel, and the gas station's going to run out of diesel. And so people didn't actually see that as a viable replacement.
So they got to put those cow patties to work? I mean, what? Which is an idea. I mean, that's one of the things that we talked about in the 70s when I was living up by Mount Hood, was like doing methane generation. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so what are the options?
Most people want something a lot easier than that. and that's really across the board. I've found that's true. Like, I was talking to some people in Vermont actually recently who had decided not to get solar panels. And I was like, why? Because they went through the whole process. And then in the end, the reason that they didn't want them is because during a power outage, they would also be out of power. Because solar panels, by definition, they feed the electricity that they produce back into the grid. So when you have solar panels on your house, you're using grid-provided electricity, but your wire runs two directions, and you're providing electricity back out onto the grid. So if the grid's down, you're down.
But actually,
and I can explain the sort of the physics of that later if you want. But with a diesel generator, it's not the case.
But actually, can't you put up? I mean, people don't do this generally because it's not really that practical. But couldn't you put solar panels in your house that weren't connected to the grid?
You can, but the problem is that because they don't, there's no. So a generator has all of this heavy metal inside of it. So it has a sort of inertial. It has an inertial reserve. To it. So like if you're running a generator, let's say the grid's down and you're running your generator, and you go and you turn on your stove to make a cup of tea, you suddenly are drawing more on the generator than it was making instantaneously ago, right? Just whatever, a fraction of a second ago. And because there's all this heavy metal inside the generator, it can make the move from producing X amount of energy to producing Y amount of energy quite quickly and also quite smoothly. And so you can make tea. But a solar panel, it doesn't have that. So let's say it is the middle of the day and it is sunny, and you turn on your stove to make a cup of tea, there's no way to produce more electricity to match that. It's called load, but to match that demand that you've just put on your solar panel. It can't do it. So unless you have some sort of storage device, which is what a lot of people are going for now or talking about going for, that's not the car battery type, but is sort of more of this Tesla Powerwall type. Solar just doesn't work well by itself. It needs something else in order to be able to just react to the turning on and off of different, like even little tiny demands. And then, of course, if you have solar panels and it's cloudy out or it's after dark or there's a volcanic eruption and it's covered in, you know, your panels are covered in ash, right? Like, then you have no electricity. So they're in a way, they feel really good for energy independence because, in fact, you can zero out your electric bill with it. But that works because you're still connected to the larger grid.
So let's get into some of the issues about this basically 19th century or early 20th century grid that we are still living with and all these 21st century devices we have for generating electricity now. How do they fit? Because you tell another story in the beginning of the book about what there was a period where there was like so much rain in May in Oregon and Washington, and the dams were like just, I mean, the water just flowing over the dams, and the wind was blowing really, really hard, and the wind turbines were just blowing away, and they were going to overload the grid, and they basically had to shut down the wind turbines because you couldn't shut down the dams because it would kill the fish. And there's actually, I actually went back and I'd done a radio show about that, and I was listening to it a few weeks ago, and it was a little bit more debatable, I think, than a lot of environmentalists were really very critical of the decision to shut down the wind turbines and said, well, if they just only close those four Snake River dams, it's the same amount of electricity that's generated by the wind, and that we could have kept the wind turbines going. So it was a real convoluted thing, but it does show the complications of trying to put new sources of energy production onto a very antiquated grid. So what do we do about that?
Right, and I think that the thing that is, again, that's sort of surprising is that too much, we're so used to thinking in terms of shortage. Like, the 20th century was all of this story of, like, we don't have enough, right? Like, we're going to be short of energy. We're not going to be able to make it work. How is coal getting to power plants? How is oil getting into, we don't use it to make electricity now, but we did all the way up until the 1950s. Like, how are we going to deal with the fact that we don't have enough of whatever it is that we use to make electricity to enough energy sources? But the thing about renewables that's including hydro, that's sort of shocking and is, I would say, the first big thing that involves changing how one thinks for the 21st century, is that we can pretty easily make too much. So excess is one of the big problems of renewables. And what was amazing about that particular moment, which now repeats itself often, is that there was too much water in the dams, and there was too much wind. And so something had to be shut down, because there's no way to store that electricity for later. And the capacity of the wires is only, you have to have someone to use it on the other side. So wires can only carry so much. They're only rated for so much. But even if you have all the wires that you need, you still have someone, you have to have somebody to use all of that electricity right now, instantaneously. And so a lot of electricity from the gorge actually goes to L.A. County. There's a giant D.C. wire that runs down there. But even L.A. on that particular day, like, even L.A. was not enough to absorb the amount of electricity that was being produced. And so how do you deal with that? And that is, in fact, the question. People say, well, maybe storage is the way to do it. And that's, you know, we're not there yet technologically. We will be. We'll figure it out one day, I think, but we're not there yet. Other people say it's what we need to do is have a much bigger grid so that it's not just LA, but we can ask, you know, there's this giant dam being built right now up in British Columbia. And so if there's a wire that runs up north, basically you can ask that dam to shut down and then start just producing all of the electricity that's needed for BC, but maybe only for an hour or two. And then, you know, the wind stills or slows down, and then that dam can open back up again and sort of take up the difference. And so you can balance renewables regionally, which a lot of people are talking about on the western half of the grid, that this would be the way to do it. So it's not necessarily that things need to get much smaller. Maybe they need to get much bigger. But it's very, very complicated to deal with this excess. And it's very sad because at noon in Phoenix now, there are so many solar panels that there's more electricity being produced with solar than the city or any of sort of the region around can use. But then at 5 p.m., the sun goes down, and then there's no electricity. So it's like there's this excess you can't use, and it causes all this trouble. And then there's this, you know, there's this lack. And you don't have any of that excess that you can then sort of bring online to, you know, when everybody comes home and turns on their TV set and the sun is going down, solar is, you know, you have to produce power by some other means when you have solar as your base.
Well, your book was written at maybe a more optimistic time than we are in right now, since it was written, you finished it before the election.
And I know, but I'm very optimistic.
Okay, yeah, because Trump is talking about bringing back coal and all these things.
I know, and it's not going to happen.
Yeah, well,
let's
talk a little bit about that. We have to cheer people up. That's what I've been trying to do every Monday morning since last November, is to cheer people up if I can with reality. But what is up there against the current against which Trump is trying to swim in his trying to push for a return of fossil fuel? What direction is the country really going in, and the grid really going in, that will make it impossible for his dream to happen?
Well, the first thing with solar is it's just cheaper now. It's just cheaper than coal. So that's the, like, if you can just take it down to nuts and bolts, like, that's the thing. It's just cheaper to make solar panels, install solar panels, and produce electricity with solar than it is to use coal or to use nuclear. And part of the reason that the last of California's nuclear power plants is being shut down, I think in 2023 or maybe 2025, is because it's actually not cost effective anymore. So yes, it's built on a fault line. You know, yes, it's carbon neutral, but those aren't the reasons that it's, you know, that's not a reason for keeping it or the reason for shutting it down. It's being shut down because it's not cost effective against renewables. So I was talking to the Minnesota Solar Association in November, 1 week after the election, and it was all of these very, very, very lefty, many people who had been involved in solar all the way since the late 1960s with, like, big gray beards and long gray braids, you know, and they've been in it and they've been doing it, and they were all extremely optimistic. And I was quite surprised by that, because it seemed like this would be the moment that the renewables people would be wiping their eyes, and they were like, this is the moment at which we are now going to go mainstream. This is not going to be about early adopters anymore. This is going to be about everybody. And they're working out business models to make that possible. So I think there is a lot, and this is Minnesota. Like, it is kind of sunny in Minnesota, but it's not, you know, it's not Arizona. But they're going gangbusters. And part of that is about affecting policy. And part of that is just about the fact that it's now quite cheap to do.
Well, we have to go at this point, but it's really good to talk with you, Gretchen. This is very interesting. It'd be maybe nice to continue this conversation sometime, because there's a lot of things we never got to.
I know. It's so complicated.
Yes. But you do a pretty good job of making it a little bit clearer, at least in your book, which I recommend.
I hope also in the conversation. It's immensely complicated, and it's so easy to not see. You know, it's so easy to just flip the switch, and the light goes on. And you're like, okay, and that's it. Like, there isn't this sense of, like, the massiveness of the machine, which is in a state of incredible flux right now.
Well, we'll talk more about this later. We'll be in touch.
Okay.
Thanks a whole lot.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. We've been talking with Gretchen Bakke, who's author of The Grid: The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with George Polisner, who famously and publicly resigned from Oracle in protest when Oracle CEO Safra Katz joined the Trump transition team, saying, "I plan to tell the president-elect that we are with him and are here to give him help in any way we can." We'll talk about how George plans to oppose Trump in every possible and legal way. My engineer is Derek Crooks. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening.
Minus is love, Lucy, talks to the land, and the leaves fall and the pond overrises. She don't know the system, plus she don't understand. She's got all her own fuses and splices. She's not gonna fix it up too easy. The masking tape tangles, it's sticky and black, and the copper proud-headed